a subject that we haven't discussed together before, but which is at the center of an understanding of what Torah is. You see in the Seder that we read the relationship between Rebbe and Talmid. That is the idea of what it means to be a Rebbe, to be a teacher, a master in the spiritual wisdom, and to be able to give it over to a student, and what it means to be a Talmid who can drink in from the Rebbe that spiritual, mystical, human life wisdom that makes Torah what it is in the world. Let's try and understand the subject as best we can. See that the conventional understanding is that there's a Rebbe, he has certain information, certain wisdom information, he gives it over to the student, and then the student understands it, and one day he becomes himself a teacher and he gives it over. But of course that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about giving over technical information or a mechanical skill that can be conveyed by being put into words. Talking about Torah, which is an organic living entity, and therefore the relationship between the Rebbe and the Talmid is what the Torah is. If everything we say tonight just tries to in some way clarify that point, then we'll have learnt a lot. And that is that it's not what the Rebbe knows or what the Talmid knows, and it's not the information that gets given over. It's the relationship between them and the passage, the transfer of the wisdom. You're going to see that you'll only have a smile on your face during this discussion if you've had the experience yourself. To try and describe this experience is like trying to describe to somebody what marriage is like who never experienced that relationship between a man and a woman. But nevertheless, even though you would try to describe a marriage to someone and they wouldn't be able to sense what you meant, but you may just be lucky enough to inspire them enough to wish to try it. This is all we hope to do this evening. And the point that we wish to try and bring up is that the Torah lives in the electricity that's formed between the Rebbe and the Talmud. That is the Torah. It's not what the one knows or what the other knows. It's not that. It's the love that's formed between them, and it's the flow of life energy that flows between them in both directions. That is what the Torah is. And that is exactly the kind of thing that one can't understand unless one has had such a love. A lot of surprising facts and ideas, takes a lot of thinking, and ultimately it takes only through working on the idea for a long period of time and chewing it over can a person get some understanding, and that's only enough understanding to make a person understand that a person has to experience this personally. You see that we learn from the Sedra the relationship, something about the relationship between Moshe and Yoshua. In fact, possibly the ultimate lesson that we have anywhere in the relationship between a master and a initiate, a devotee, or whatever you call it, depending on which point of the compass you come from. That relationship we see, probably the primal one you see, is the relationship between Moshe and Yeshua, Moses and Joshua. Moshe Rabbeinu and Yeshua, who was his Talmid in the highest sense of the word. And we see from the interplay, the interchange, and the relationship between them, we see what a person should try and aspire to be in terms of being a Rebbe and in terms of being a Talmid. And it's all full of paradox, which is what we have to try and understand. The way a Rebbe becomes a Rebbe is by trying not to be. Somebody tries, yes, to be a Rebbe, certainly disqualifies himself for the job. If a Rebbe tries to teach someone, a man tries to go around teaching, generally speaking, he disqualifies himself. There has to be somebody who tries not to be in that position. And it has to be the kind of person that the Talmid has to pester and plague into teaching him something, and even finds it worthwhile to learn from the refusals of the Rebbe. That's the Rebbe's problem, that the Talmud pesters him. He has to put up with it. But he himself tries to take himself out of the teaching situation, because a Rebbe who's full of humility doesn't feel that he's the person to teach. In terms of being a Rebbe, in terms of being a model, being a role model for a person who needs to be educated and brought out of himself, to develop himself. So you see the relationship between the two of them, and some of the elements that we see there we'll have to trace into the mystical world to understand how this relationship works. Hashem tells Moshe that he's about to die. But from here on in, the Torah readings from this point of the year on, they run towards the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life. It all takes place at the very end of his life. The whole of Sefer Dvarim takes place on the last day of his life, and we have the wording, the legacy that he gives over to the Jewish people, how he inspires Yeshua, how he teaches him, the legacy, what he leaves him with, the inspiration, the message, the task that he leaves him. We see all that. Hashem says to Moshe that you're about to die. The first comment Moshe makes is not, why do I have to die now, even though we know he had a tremendously strong desire to live. He certainly didn't accept it and take it lying down. In the mystical sources it says, actually the Gemara brings it, that when the Malach HaMavis came to take him away, he beat him off. When the angel that ends a person's life, when that power, that spiritual emanation came to claim him, when his time was due, in fact, he was able to beat him off. And he gave the angel serious problems, it says in the Gemara. He wasn't able to do his job. Moshe Rabbeinu had such merit, he certainly wasn't taking the announcement that he was about to die passively. And the announcement that he wasn't going to live to enter the world of Eretz Yisrael, which is the higher land, as it's called, Eretz Aliyona, the higher land, the world of Kedusha. But nevertheless, the first thing he said was, Hashem, do not let the Jewish people be like a flock without a shepherd. Right? Organize for them. The first comment he makes, immediately, before he even thinks about it for himself, he says, the first thing he says is, let there be a man who will go before them, he'll lead them in, lead them out, guide them, let them not be leaderless. That's his first concern. You learn from this, of course, that although the Rebbe must be a man who tries to take himself out of leadership, the Moshe Rabbeinu had a most massive cosmic argument with Hashem. When Hashem said to him, you the man, I want you to go into Egypt and lead the Jewish people, bring them to their final deliverance, their fulfillment, you to be the man who will be the ultimate redeemer through all generations. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes up with enormous power of argument to convince Hashem why he's the wrong man. I can't speak properly, people won't understand me, I don't have the stature, I'm not this, I'm not that. He argues and argues until Hashem gets upset with him and virtually forces him into the job. That's the man who doesn't want leadership, but once he has leadership thrust upon him, the only thing that he thinks of is the students. I remember when I left Kollel to be somebody who was setting out in life to try and be somebody who could give over some Torah ideas. Don't make any mistakes. It doesn't mean to be a Rebbe. To be a Rebbe, you have to be somebody. Let's not get confused here. You have to be somebody. It has to shine out. But certainly a person can say over words of Torah that he heard from other people. In fact, in this generation, we need even people who are severely handicapped in Torah to be teaching, because we're in such a desperate situation that even people who don't know anything virtually have to teach those who know less. There's no question about it. That's not what we're talking about in terms of being a model that is a Rebbe. But nevertheless, when I went out to be somebody who would try and further his own learning by trying to express it to others, so when I went to say goodbye to my Rosh Kollel, he said to me just one thing. He said, the Talmidim. He said, the love for them, and you do everything for them. Nothing must be too much for you. That's all he said. That means that what he gave me as a message that should be an inspiration for me was obviously what he felt himself. And then I suddenly realized what it is that he did for us, and the energies, the effort that he put himself in to understand what it means, that kind of devotion. Now let's try and trace this relationship to the deepest roots that we're able to, and then let's try and understand how the relationship manifests itself. So in the sources that talk about it, they say something like this: that the source of this relationship, if you want to understand the origin, where it is that a Rebbe and Talmid relate, and where we learn that from, where the source is of this idea, then there's an amazing sugya, amazing discussion in the Talmud, in the mystical sources, especially in the Kabbalistic writings, that talk about a relationship between a teacher, between a husband, let's say, and a wife, because Rebbe and Talmid are always likened to husband and wife. Try to understand it. And of course, it's easy to understand just from that idea alone that husband and wife function not what one gives to the other. It's not the fact that one is able to give something to the other one, or that one receives from the other in either direction. That's not the point. The point is the love that is built between them. It's the relationship that flourishes between husband and wife. That's what the whole thing's all about. Immediately understand that parallel. So the Kabbalistic writings say that the first time there was this relationship, actually there was, it didn't happen before, but the first time we see it in the structure of the world, that's far enough for us to trace it. If we get, maybe on some other occasion, we can trace it further. Some of it's forbidden to be spoken about, But at this level, it's certainly not forbidden to be spoken about. And that is that they trace it back to the relationship between the sun and the moon. Now, that's a very remarkable thing. But let's see what we can understand. So it says in these particular sources that the sun and the moon were created equal. That's what it says. So I understand now. We're trying to understand the relationship between the one who gives and the one who receives, what it should be and what it's broken down to in the world as we know it. So the Kabbalistic sources, they say that explicit sources, also that's learned from Sukkim, they say that the sun and moon were created equal. And then the moon said, try not to get caught up in the childlike marshal. Let's try and understand what it means at root. But the moon said anyway to Hashem, Ein shnei melochim meshamshim bekesa echad. There cannot be two kings ruling with one crown. That means we cannot both rule. That's what she said. She spoke up and said we cannot both rule, one or the other. When the moon said that, so Hashem said to the moon, Lechi umamati es atzmech, go and lessen yourself, shrink yourself down. Gave the moon a command. I understand what this means. The commentary is going to great detail. What do you mean they spoke to Hashem? What do you mean they said something wrong? The moon doesn't have free will. That means that she was created to be that way. So why do you call it a breakdown then? Most of these things can only be understood in that zone where there aren't any words, as much of our discussions have to be understood. But nevertheless, let's just take the face value for what it's worth at the moment. When the moon said to Hashem that we can't both rule two kings with the same crown, Hashem said, you spoke, you go and lessen yourself. And the moon shrunk itself to be a very faint reflection of what the sun is. Now the commentaries explain that before the moon said that, she wasn't producing the light that the sun. The person has to understand that it's not that there were two suns before. Nowhere does it say that Hashem created two suns that were equal. Absolutely not. He created a sun and a moon, but they were equal. So the commentaries explain what it means is that there was a sun and there was a moon. The one was a giver and the one was a receiver. The one was that which pours out its light, and the moon was only able to reflect. She wasn't able to give her own light. She was only able to reflect. But the amazing thing about it is that she was able to reflect everything that she received. The relationship between man and woman is supposed to be that in which the man gives and the woman receives. But as we try to point out many times in the discussions, what it means to be male, what it means to be female, it doesn't mean that one's active and one's passive. On the contrary, everything happens in the woman. It's on the woman's side, the female side, where that receiving is done, that the reality is turned out. That when a woman receives what will become a child, in whichever way it is, physically or emotionally, from a husband, then what happens is the process of birth takes place from her. She's the one. If you want to know between Rebbe and Talmid where the Torah comes down to the world, it comes down from Talmid. Until the Rebbe's given it over, you don't have it. It's only when somebody's able to receive it correctly that we have it in the world. That's what it means. The child is born from the woman. Torah as the product of what will be born from this relationship. So that is what comes out of it. And that's only given over from the one who receives it. So we need both of them. But the point is that the way the relationship was before is that they were both equal. Whatever the sun was able to produce, the moon reflected exactly. And what happened after she said what she shouldn't have said, she was sent into a situation that they called exile, golus. And that was reflected by the fact that she had to shrink herself down, and so she could only reflect a very, very small percentage of what the sun is. And of course that represents what the Jewish people are. We are in a situation of exile. We reflect only a small amount of Kedusha. Finally it says that we will be resurrected, as it were, to our full, be able to reflect Hashem's grandeur, greatness, glory fully once a month, right? We go through a cycle that's female, once a month, just like a woman's cycle. We stand and we look at the moon and we make a bracha. And the words of the bracha are that Hashem should, as soon as possible, He should swell the moon again, like that woman of the heavens. They should swell her again to the size and the greatness and the clarity at which she can reflect exactly what the sun's giving. It's boring.
made it complicated. Huh?
Good mutter.
I'm not trying hard enough.
Okay, if you... That person needs musa once in a while. Okay. There's an amazing discussion in the Gemara that traces the parallel of this event between the major, the Rebbe and the Talmud, whom we started off talking about. The Gemara says, very, very amazing discussion. The Gemara says the following thing. On the day when Moshe died, now he died I think at midday, 7th of Adar, the last day of his life. The day that Moshe died, so he said to Yoshua, Shem commanded him, take Yoshua and command him in front of all the people that he will now be the leader, give him of your spirit, let rest upon him some of the Kedusha, some of the aura that surrounds you, let him become the leader of the Jewish people. So Moshe says to Yoshua the following words, amazing thing, he does that in front of everybody, he strengthens him, he gives him words of tremendous power and strength, and then he says to him the following thing, they're not recorded in Chumash, Gemara brings, he says to him the following thing, Yoshua, ask me any doubt that you still have left. What still bothers you? Listen to this conversation, amazing thing. Conversation between Rebbe and Talmud. So understand that before we go into this discussion, let's try and understand a little bit the closeness between them. The closeness between them was a love that possibly no one else has ever experienced. The love between Rebbe and Talmud, the love that flows both ways between them. So in all the places where you read about this, they explain that it's one of the greatest loves that could ever be. It's greater in many ways than the love of a child for his parent or parent for a child, and the husband and wife have for each other, in many ways. There are certain halachas that state the obligation of this relationship, that sometimes a child has to save the life of his Rebbe before the life of his father. There are situations where if a child can only save the life of one, and he has only to save the life of his Rebbe or his father, amazingly, there are situations in which he must save his Rebbe's life. And in halacha it's brought clearly why. It says because the father brings a child into this world, but the Rebbe brings him into the next world. And therefore your obligation spiritually is deeper in that way. It's deeper. There are many commentaries. There are commentaries to say, a very amazing chiddush, a beautiful, amazing idea, that a father who's not able to teach his son Torah, what happens if a father can teach his son Torah and he teaches him? So he's his father and his Rebbe. The father teaches his son. His children teaches them the Torah that he's obliged to. And he gives them their inspiration and their start and their depth in Torah. So then he's the father and the Rebbe. So then he certainly takes precedence. Because he's both. He certainly... So if a father... What about a father who can't? Or a mother? What about a parent who cannot teach his child Torah? Doesn't know himself. So then Mephoshim will say this. Let him pay for a Rebbe to teach his child. Because if he employs a teacher, if he employs a Rebbe, if he pays heavily, then his child should learn Torah. Not all Jewish education is Torah, by the way. Some Jewish education is decidedly anti-Torah. Won't mention any names, but... Some Jewish education. Much of it. Most of it isn't Jewish even. But if a parent pays, if a father pays for his son to learn Torah, which is Torah, so then he gets the law, he acquires for himself the name of being a father and the Rebbe. Because since he's the one who's employing the Rebbe, so the Rebbe is only acting as an agent, as a shliach. That means that you can do a mitzvah through a shliach. You can even marry a woman through a shliach. If you send an agent to Makadosh a woman, to say to a woman, behold, you are now betrothed to such and such a man, and you do it on his behalf, she becomes engaged to him. So an agent can do a mitzvah for you, with certain exceptions. An agent can do a mitzvah for you. And therefore, it's better to do it yourself, but an agent can do it. And therefore, if you send a shliach, therefore if a father, instead of teaching his child, pays someone to learn, to teach him, so then the father gets the deal of being the Rebbe and the father. And then, of course, his life gets, if you want to be assured that in such a crisis, your son will not vacillate on the banks of the river, working out at whom to save, so then a parent must at least pay so that his son, child, can learn Torah, and then he will have both in him. But that's the relationship. And if you've ever seen or heard or read about the love of a Rebbe for his Talmud, or if you've ever seen anyone who's experienced it, and you feel the glow with which he glows when he speaks about his Rebbe, or you've ever seen any of the relationship between them, then you'll understand something of what it means to have a feeling that a person received life from somebody else, but in a conscious way. In a conscious way, spiritual love. That was the feeling that existed between them. The closeness was indescribable. It says when Moshe went up the mountain to receive Torah, and he stayed away for 40 days, So Yeshua pitched his tent at the border of the zone where humans were allowed to go. In other words, the Jewish people were encamped in the camp. Moshe went up the mountain. Beyond the border of the mountain, no human was allowed to go. So Yeshua went out of the camp and he pitched his tent on the border. In fact, he was so far out of the camp that when they came down again together and there was a sound of an uproar in the camp, which was the Jews who had sinned, and Yeshua thought it was a war, he didn't know what was going on. He wasn't in the camp. He said to his teacher, in fact, even from that you learn the relations between Rabbi and Talmid. He said, Rabbi, there's a sound of war in the camp. As they got close and they heard, the Jews were celebrating a tremendous sin that they'd perpetrated, the golden calf. So he said, Rabbi, I hear the sound of war. So like a true teacher, Moshe said to him, you don't know how to listen. He said to him, I don't hear a sound of war. I don't hear sounds of victory and sounds of vanquished. That's not the sound of war. It's much worse than that. And he was right. But it means he taught him a lesson. That everything he said, he taught him how to say right. But while the two of them were away from the camp, Moshe was up in Shemayim receiving Torah. Yehoshua was camped on the border. So Mephoshim asked, but what was he doing there? What difference did it make? He wasn't going to see his Rebbe any sooner. He knew he was away for 40 days. Moshe told him he wasn't coming back for 40 days. So he could have gone back home and lived normally for 39 days. A few hours before he expected him, he could have, but that's not the way Talmid behaves. That's not the way. Logic? Don't ask me. That's not the way Talmid behaves. He went and he pitched his tent. He stayed for 40 days at the last, where the last footsteps of his Rebbe had faded into the distance. That's where he stayed. To be there to greet him when he came back, but not just to be there when he came back, but to have been there since he went away. Well, that's the way he thought. I'm not talking about children here, or trained puppy. We're talking about the greatest men who ever lived. But that's how he manifested his love for him. So when these two men faced each other on the last day of Moshe's life, you now have a Talmid facing his Rebbe and he's saying goodbye. Hashem has told him you're about to die. Not like it happened suddenly and he didn't know about it. And his Rebbe was in full strength. It says that his fluids, his body fluids, his body strength hadn't dried in any way. He was full. At age 120, he was as powerful as he'd ever been. He stood in front of Yeshua and he said to him, I'm about to leave. This is the parting. This is how the parting sounded. Listen to this. You have to hear. So he said to him, Yeshua, ask me any doubts you have. I'm about to leave. It's your last chance. What do you still need to be taught? But again, that's his only concern. So Yeshua answers him as follows. He says to him the following thing. Have I ever left you? Have I left you for a moment? Did you not write in your own Torah that Yeshua is a nar? Nar means like a little lad who has always trailed his master and been with him. Have I left you for a moment? Is there anything left for me to learn? Is there anything that I could ask you at this stage? And he didn't ask him any questions. And instead of asking him a question and being taught, he said to him that I can't learn anymore. For whatever reason, I can't learn. The Gemara says an amazing thing. Miyat. Immediately Moshe's mind became weak. His mind became weak. And according to another opinion, Tashash Koichel Yeshua, Yeshua's power sapped. That means the two, whichever one, but one or both of them, they both sank spiritually. And immediately it says, in Yeshua's mind were born 300 questions and 700 doubts. Well, it says also, why 300 and 700? What it means, 3 and 7 and 1,000, not for us right now. But the point is, that's what it is. In other words, he had no doubts. He had no doubts before. But because he didn't put himself into a situation of receiving from the Rebbe, so instantaneously what happened was, he had 300 questions that he couldn't answer, and 700 doubts. There was a tremendous fracture. Right? The world shattered at that moment. What actually happened over there? What happened exactly? What went wrong? What happened? So if you have any ear to hear words of Torah, then you hear the sun and the moon facing each other. And you hear the sun and the moon going through the experience that they went through. Because it says quite openly in the sages, it says quite openly, Pnei Moshe ke Pnei Chama. The face of Moshe is like the face of the sun. Pnei Yehoshua ke Pnei Levana. The face of Yehoshua is like the face of the moon. Well, they're not being poetic when they say he was like the sun and he was like the moon. They mean literally. They mean that he was a Rebbe who shone like the sun. He was Moshe who gave the Torah. And he was Yehoshua who shone like a moon. That means he was able to receive everything. He was a Talmid of the level that he was able to receive the whole Torah. Absolutely. He didn't receive the Torah at the level that Moshe received it. He didn't have that experience. But he received everything that Moshe had at that level. What happened? Moshe said to him, what do you still need to learn? In other words, I'm the Rebbe and I'm teaching you. Says Yehoshua to Moshe, how can I learn more from you? At that moment when he doesn't put himself anymore into the position of being a Talmid, at that moment he's learning God. He loses 1,000 Torah That means a complete cycle, a complete unit of Torah, he loses immediately. Why did he do that? The commentaries also talk, why did he do that? Why did he say that? Why didn't he put himself, what did he understand? There's a special halacha that says on the day of death there's no rule. A king does not rule on the day of his death. Moshe, it was the last day of his life, Yeshua understood that Moshe couldn't rule anymore on that day. That because of the halacha that on the last day of the king's life he doesn't rule. So Yeshua had to force himself into the situation of not accepting. He had to do that. The Chassidim say, the Belz of Chassidim, if I'm not mistaken, they tell a story about the Rebbe. Belz or Geir of Chassidim tell a story about the Sos Emes, well, generation after him. On the day that he became the Rebbe, they said to him, "But your father, the previous Rebbe, he did such and such." So his comment was, "Heint rejanger ich." Today I rejanger is a word, the Polish word. It means I spin the dreidel, what you spin on Purim, Kragar it's called, the Rashan, yes. I'm spinning, I revolve, I rotate the world today. Now, you must know that the prime qualification for any Rebbe in Torah has always been tremendous humility, even those who were sharp and fiery. But what they manifested most deeply was tremendous humility. He didn't mean I'm in charge in a sense of pride. He meant that I have the obligation from now. And don't tell me what was done before. And the Chassidim point out that that statement actually shows a paradoxical opposite at one and the same time. It shows subservience to the previous pathway and it shows complete originality. How does it show both of them? Because they say that what happened was, he said to the Rebbe, they came to a young man who had just become the Rebbe of a Hasidic dynasty, and they said to him, "Why do you change everything that your father did? Why don't you follow the traditions? Why aren't you like your father? He was a great Rebbe and you change everything." So he said to them, "I'm exactly like my father. He copied no one and neither do I." In other words, but that's what it is. So Yeshua, when he became the Rebbe, so when it was his day to rule, knowing the halacha, he stood up to Moshe Rabbeinu and he said to him, the one is ultimate beloved, and he said to him, "I've learned everything and I have it now and I'm now to lead." And at that moment the relationship, incredible shudder took place, and he was shown. So the mystical commentaries say what you see there was literally the sun and the moon shining equally, and the moon saying that we cannot both rule. There's a transition now, and Hashem says to the moon, "You freeze yourself, shrink yourself," which is what happened to Yeshua. Shrunk. Unable to reflect anymore the full light of Torah. Now, in this relationship, and that's where we are today. Today we're in a situation where the transmission of Torah, this love, this relationship, while it's everything we have, but it's never a full reflection. That's the way it is. And we daven for the day when there'll be a full reflection, and the whole Torah will be again in the world. But nevertheless, the last scraps of it that we have are everything that we have. And the obligation today a person has to know, the obligation is that a person has to make himself a Rebbe. It says in Birka Avos Asei Lecha Rav, you must make a Rav, you must make a Rebbe. Go and make yourself a teacher. So the commentaries say, the Rambam talks about it. What do you mean make yourself a teacher? Of course you make yourself a teacher. That's what the Torah has always been given over from every Talmud. So what do you have to tell me for? Says the Rambam, an incredible chiddush. He says this, it means make yourself a teacher even if he's not fitting. That means even if you can't find somebody great enough to be a Rebbe, choose anybody who's at least a little bit better than you. Because Torah only comes in the love of the transmission from one to another. That means if you can't find the perfect husband or wife, but you have the mitzvah to get married, you take the best you can.
Why they love? Only the women, eh? It's totally silent on this one. It's very interesting to stand in this position because you hear the distance between you. There's totally silence from this side of the room. Since we've entered this arena, let's just state the following fact. Is that whoever you marry is destined. It means that the perfect person, whether you think they're less than perfect or not, has been set up 40 days before a person's conceived. And if you make the right effort, you'll definitely find that person.
Definitely.
And by the Rebbe, it says the same thing. That who will be the person's Rebbe, who will teach him, will be made available to him. Who will be the master, will be made available. And who will be the Talmid, who a Rebbe will have to give over his Torah to, will be found. Not if he looks for them. Not if he looks for them. I was once sitting at a shul with my Rebbe, and he made a certain comment. So one of the people said, "But Rebbe, how will we teach people? How will we find people to teach?" So he said to him, he looked at him sadly, and he said to him, "Never mind teaching anybody. Fix yourself up." That's what he said. "Fix yourself up, and suddenly one day you'll find a few stragglers hanging onto the back of your wagon." That's the way he put it. A few stragglers, one day, you'll find, you'll look around, and your miserable wagon, traveling down a bumpy road, you'll find a few unfortunates hanging onto the back of your wagon. Didn't put it exactly like that. Which means that it's only when you're not looking for it, but if you work hard on yourself, so then there'll be those who want to receive from you. But the obligation is to make a ring. The Rambam goes so far as to say that if you can't find any Rebbe at all, teach yourself. Teach yourself. In other words, it doesn't say learn, it says teach yourself. It's a very interesting thing. Torah goes only by being given from one to another. And even if you have to do it to yourself, because Torah only comes by what's called Kabbalah Satara. That means receiving it. That means making yourself an empty vessel, having defeated your ego completely, being completely filled with pride, let's call it emptied, and therefore you could receive. But only where there's a vessel. And therefore, even if you've no one to teach you, you don't learn. What you do is you empty yourself and let yourself receive, even though you're doing it to yourself. But you have to be in that position of being an empty vessel which receives in order to receive Torah. And therefore, a person has to look desperately. How does it happen? It happens in mystical ways. When the Arizal came to Tzfat, the Arizal was the great Kabbalistic master from whose mouth we live. His writings, his teachings, let's say. He didn't write them, but his teachings, which were written down by his great Talmid, Reb Chaim Vital, in Tzfas, in the late 1500s, 1570s. He was a man who came from Egypt when he was 37 years old. He was told that he had a Talmid, that there was a man who would be able to drink in his Torah, and he moved, he travelled to Tzfas, and there he found Reb Chaim Vital. And Reb Chaim sat with him, and he learned from him. There were those who couldn't receive from him. Sometimes a Rebbe and a Talmid cannot, Rebbe and a Rebbe cannot be a Rebbe of a Talmid, and a Talmid can't be a Talmid of that Rebbe. I'll illustrate this for you by what happened with Arizal. It says when he came to Tzfas, amazing, amazing story. Again, you have to understand this very carefully. But when Arizal came to Tzfas, knowing that he had a Talmid who was waiting for him, having been told in the mystical spheres that there would be a Talmid waiting for him to teach, who would find him if he was in the right place. So he came from Mitzrayim, where he was learning in the banks of the Nile in a hut by himself. Young man in his 30s, he came to Tzfas, and late one afternoon he walked into Tzfas. And he went to David in the shul of the Beis Yosef. In those days, in 1500, in Tzfat, Tzfat in those days was a place that was incandescent with Kedusha. The people who were in Tzfat at the time were Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, a great Kabbalist himself, Rav Yosef Kodavero, the Tome Devoira. He was there. There was an assembly of great men in Tzfat, which was on a level that, I mean, the assembly there, the Arizal and his Talmidim were on a completely transcendent plane. I mean, they almost reinstituted Smicha, that they would have a Sanhedrin again, that they decided not to do it. Many, many stories. One Friday afternoon, Arizal went out into the fields with his Talmidim around him, some of these great men. And Tzfas, a long way from Yerushalayim, as you know. It's a long, long journey from Tzfas to Yerushalayim. As they went out into the fields, as the sun went down, there were seconds to go before Shabbos. They went out to receive the Shabbos. Their tradition was to go out towards the Shabbos. Great Kabbalistic tradition. We do it today. We turn around in shul in order to greet the Shabbos. But they went out of town. At a particular instant when there were seconds to go, the Arizal turned to his Talmud and he said, "Let's go to Yerushalayim." And one of them hesitated and he said, "Yes, we'll just tell our wives." And he said, "You lost it. Too late." But they were on the verge. They could have done almost anything that assembly. The Arizal arrived in Tzfas. And he walked into the shul of the Beis Yosef. And the Moed Asra, that means the leader of that great and amazing generation of Jews, was the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo. And he was davening in the Midrash. He was standing at the head of the congregation, and they were davening Mincha. So when everyone finished davening,
Rav Yosef carried on davening. He was davening long. It took him long. And the Shliach Tzibur, the Chazan, waited for him, as was the custom. But it took rather long. So this young stranger, in his 30s, in this great assembly of giants, he walked up to the Chazan and he said, "Start. For the sweat of a donkey we don't wait." Understand this. Understand the sharpness. What it means. Try and explain a little bit more. So the Chazan was very shocked and he started davening. So after the tefillah, there's a famous story about how he met his, how they met. How they met. After the tefillah, Yav Rosef Karo went up to the Chazan and he said to him, "What happened today? Normally you wait for me to finish davening. I know it was taking a bit longer, but normally you wait. What happened?" So the Chazan was shocked into admitting. He said, "Well, this young man arrived," and he said, "For the sweat of a donkey we don't wait." So Rav Yosef said, "How did he know what I was thinking? I was standing there at the end of my tefillah, trying to work out that if a donkey is carrying flour in panniers on his back, and the donkey sweats, is it machmitz the flour? Does the flour become chometz or not? And I couldn't figure out this halachic question. How did he know what I was thinking?" So he said, that's how they met. So they sat down to learn Kabbalah together. They sat down to learn Kabbalah. And every time that Rizal started teaching, Rav Yosef Karo fell asleep. So the Arizal told him that his Sherish Neshama wasn't for him. That means the place that his Neshama came from in the higher worlds was not for him. That means he was not able to receive from that source. The two of them couldn't connect and they didn't learn together. And in fact the Kabbalistic pathway that the two of them had was a completely different pathway. And shortly after that he met Reb Chaim Vital, who was his student, who stayed with him for 18 months. And the two of them entered a relationship that we are alive today from, because Reb Chaim took down everything that Arizal said in many different versions, and all the writings of Arizal we have today from the hand of Reb Chaim and a few others who lived in Tzfat at the same time. Until about 18 months later, less than 2 years later, the relationship ended. It ended with the death of Arizal, who wasn't even 40. How did he die? Because his Talmid came to him one day and he said, "Rebbe, teach me a certain thing. Reveal to me a certain area." And Arizal said to him, explained to him that the connection between them was such that he couldn't reveal to him that area of Torah. And Reb Chaim begged him to reveal it to him. So Arizal agreed and he revealed to him and he said to him quite calmly and plainly, "Because I've revealed that to you, it's cost my life." Shortly after that, he died. There are other cases like that also. And then Reb Chaim, then before and after, wrote down everything that he'd received from Arizal, and that's what we have. So the destiny, if you like, of who has to give to whom and how he'll be found is a deep mystical element of the relationship between Rebbe and Talmid. Now, in this relationship, in this giving, you have to understand some areas that are paradoxical and subtle, as we mentioned before. One of them is that the flow has to be because there's a suckling of the Talmid. If a mother wishes to feed, to nurse, and the child won't suckle, the child cannot grow, cannot drink. The Gemara says that the desire of a Rebbe to teach, has to understand very carefully, very, very carefully what mistakes can happen. The Gemara says the following thing, frightening things. The Gemara says that once it happened that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that was the author of the Zohar, himself one of the greatest teachers we ever had, once he was in jail, and his Rebbe was none other than Rebbe Akiva. So Rebbe Akiva came to see him. He was jailed by the Romans for teaching Torah, for being involved in Torah, which happened to Rebbe Akiva later. Also, he was tortured to death by the Romans because of that. But when Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai was in jail for having taught Torah, Rebbe Akiva came to visit him. So the Gemara says, records the following incredible conversation. When he came to visit him in jail, came to visit him through the bars, from outside the window, whatever it was, so Rebbe Shimon said to his Rebbe one thing. He said, "Rebbe, landeini Torah, teach me Torah. Now, here and now, teach me. What else are we together for? Teach me." So Rebbe Akiva said to him, "Eini milam, I'm not going to teach you. I'm not going to." Why? Why didn't he want to teach him? Because he was in danger. His life was in danger. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was in jail for teaching and learning Torah. And therefore, if Rabbi Akiva would have engaged him in a Torah conversation, any of the Roman guards would have heard, so for sure it would have been very bitter with him. So Rabbi Akiva said, "I'm not going to teach you." So listen to the words. So Shimon Bar Yochai says to him, "If you don't teach me Torah, I'm going to..." And he threatened death. Threatened the death of Rabbi Akiva. Can't say these words if the Gemara didn't say. He said, "If you don't tell me, I'm going to report you to Yochai Abba, to my father Yochai, who knows certain things about you, and he's going to tell the Romans, and they're going to finish you off." I'm going to speak that way to his Rebbe? Understand this. Learn out from this that there are some cases of needing to learn Torah that you can even threaten That means that even by a human hand you can threaten amazing things. I mean, that the Torah has to come out in the world. Understand this. It's a life that has to come out. Anyway, it's very hard for us to understand. So Rabbi Kiva said in the following thing, Bani, my son. That's how the Rabbi speaks to his Talmud. My son. And it's not an accident that he calls him my son. Because the commentaries all explain that a Talmud is a real son. The father is the son of the body. But as we explained before, the Rebbe is the father of the neshama. And it says that the people he makes with his words are his real children. His real children. And therefore he called him his son. And he said to him, Bani, Yoser, more than the cow wants, more than the calf wants to suckle, the cow wants to nurse. More than the calf wants to suckle, the cow wants to give milk. In other words, don't think that I'm withholding Torah because I don't want to teach you. You think your desire for Torah is strong, so strong that you're prepared to brave death. You should know that the cow wants to nurse more than the calf wants to drink. That's what the Gemara says. And then the discussion continues. But the point is, we learn from that discussion that the desire of the Rebbe to give is stronger than the desire of the Talmid to receive. But the problem is, like all the areas that go, all the issues that are involved in this relationship, it's always misunderstood. It's always misunderstood. And I heard this from a great Rosh Yeshiva, a very great man, Zayn Gesund, Asimcha Wasserman. I heard from him the following incident. He said, I was sitting learning with him one night, somebody else, and he said that more than the calf wants to drink, the cow wants to nurse. And then he leant across the table and he said, he's a teacher. This man is a real teacher. He's in his 90s, beyond ice cold blue eyes. Narrowed his eyes and he said, you know what that means? And he knew who he was speaking to. Somebody wanted to be involved in giving Torah over in some way. He said, everyone misunderstands. People think it means that the Rebbe wants to give. When it says in the Gemara that the Rebbe wants to give more than the calf wants to drink, you think it means the Rebbe wants to give. Completely wrong. It doesn't mean the Rebbe wants to give. It means the Rebbe wants the calf to drink. The Rebbe wants the calf. The cow doesn't want... Again, you have to understand. See, mothers understand this. Mothers understand. People think that when the Gemara says the calf wants to give more than the cow wants to give more than the calf wants to drink, so people think it means that the cow is uncomfortable with her milk. She wants to give out her milk. She's uncomfortable. She needs to pour out the milk. That's what it means. But it doesn't mean that. The cow will give her life for the calf. Not because she doesn't want the milk. She wants to pour out the milk. She wants the calf to drink. That's the point. That means you can so badly misunderstand this Gemara, unless you have a real Rebbe, unless you've met a great man once who could explain it to you. So you'd think that a Rebbe has a desire to teach Torah, but that's not what he has. The Rebbe has a desire that the student should learn. It's a very different thing. It's a massively different thing. If the Rebbe has a desire to teach, he'll find any Talmid that he can, and he'll pour it out on him. And he might kill him. He might drown him. He might not make a Torah mentality. But if the Rebbe wants that the Talmid should learn, he'll find the right Talmud, and he'll wait until it's right, and he'll only teach him what he needs, and he'll do it with love and concern. A mother doesn't want to mother. A mother doesn't want to mother a child, but she might smother a child. What a mother wants to do is the child should be mothered. The child should have what it needs. And if it involves self-control, if it involves not giving, if the child needs that the mother should manifest control and not give, then she'll do that for the child. And if the child needs that it should be given, the mother will give. And that's what a Rebbe is. A Rebbe is not somebody who tries to offload what he has because he wants to give, and he wants to be famous or great or a teacher. A Rebbe is somebody who understands what the Talmud can add, and he won't drown him. Rav Wasserman told me an example. He told me that night an example that he'd seen of somebody who understood wrong. It was a case, he said, when he was in Europe, and he received the Talmud after the war. A Talmud came to his yeshiva, and he sat and learned with him. He sat and learned, I think, Becheris. They sat and learned together. And as they started to learn, he said that this Talmud was a brilliant student, and everything he said was irrelevant. They started learning the Gemara, they'd read the Gemara, when they started on the Rashi, this Talmud started saying things about the Rashi that were completely irrelevant. He was a brilliant mind, and he couldn't say a thing that was relevant. His learning was completely crumb. Everything he said was offline. So Rav Wasserman asked him a little bit about his background, and it turned out the following thing. When this boy was young, when this young Talmud was a boy, I have to hear this, people who are teachers and parents, people are concerned about their children, education, as I understand, that when this bocher was young, he went to a certain yeshiva in Europe where the custom was that they took a young boy and they gave him to an older boy to teach. That means to break him in, to give him an initiation, to give him a help in the yeshiva. So they sat him with someone more mature who knew more, and the older one taught the younger one. And unfortunately, this youngster had been given to an older bocher who wanted to impress. He wanted to impress. He wasn't concerned about his learning. He wanted to show how much he knew. So whatever they came across, it was vaguely connected to something he knew. He would offload what he called, and it wasn't called his peklach, of Torah, he'd offload it on this youngster and tell him a brilliancy, but was irrelevant to... In other words, he wasn't concerned what this bocha needed to learn. He wasn't concerned with bringing out his abilities and developing his talents. He wanted to show him much, so he developed. The youngster grew up that way. And this youngster became a person who couldn't think straight. I mean, all he had learned in his youth, very amazing thing, and Rav Asher said he had to stop learning with him. And therefore, that's what it means. The Rebbe's concerned only for the Talmud. He doesn't care. He comes to the level of self-sacrifice that he doesn't care if he gives or just like the love of a parent. Now you'll see that the way it goes, the pathway that it goes, the way the Rebbe gives over to the Talmud, you'll see it goes according to personality. And therefore only certain Rebbeim can give to certain Talmud. And the Talmud often doesn't understand. When the Rebbe teaches, he says things that the Talmud has to raise himself up to understand. I once heard from Rav David Weiss, who was a Mashgiach in the Kollel where I was studying in Yerushalayim. He told me the following thing. He told us the following thing one day. He told us an embarrassing story about himself. He said that when he was young, he went to Rav Volbl, his Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Weiss's Rosh Yeshiva was the famous, is the famous Rav Volbl, Zankazim. Lived in Yerushalayim today, one of the greatest exponents of Musa. He wrote Al Ashur. Famous, he's a great and famous man. He's a great exponent and famous for his approach to character building, character development. Bal Musa. He runs the base of Musa in Shalom. Very great man. Spent many years in Scandinavia. Written books in English, Hebrew. So when Rav Weiss was a young man, starting out in Yeshiva, he decided that he wanted to become great in Musa. Like his Rebbe. He wanted to be like his Rebbe. So he decided the following thing. He's going to go and ask his Rebbe that he should really teach him Musa. Musa, character building, working on your personality. So he should really amount to something. Develop some sort of character greatness. So one day he went in private to his Rebbe, and he sat down with him and he said, Rebbe, I want to come to you. Please, I'm begging you. I want to come and sit with you in private, every week or every 2 weeks, and I want you to tell me everything that's wrong with me. Break me down, I can take it. I want you to tell me exactly what's wrong with me. I'm a battle myself to you. I annul myself before you as a Talmud should. Tell me what's wrong with me. Break me down, tell me where my problems are, and I'll work on them, and I'll really do my best. So Rav Volbl said to him the following thing. He said, you don't mean that. You don't mean that. All you want is to be able to tell your friends that you sat in private with the Rosh Yeshiva. That's all you want. You're just seeking honor. That's all. You don't want to build yourself. You haven't even begun. You don't even know what your problems are. You're so full of gaiva. You're so full of pride. And all you want is to go out of here and say, the Rosh Yeshiva told me what's wrong with me. He told me where I'm lacking. He personally sat and he told me this about me and this about me and this and so forth and so on. Rav Weiss said he was so humbled, he was so ashamed. He crept out of the room. And he couldn't bring himself to speak to Rav Volbl for many months. He couldn't fight him. After being exposed like that, I mean, it cut to the core. It was exactly what he was thinking. It cut so deeply, he couldn't fight his Rosh Hashanah for months. Many months later, they passed in the yeshiva. So Rav Volbl said, what happened to you? So Rav Weiss said, Rebbe, what do you mean what happened to me? He said, why did you never come back? Why did you never come to me? So he said, but Rebbe, you told me such terrible things about my... He said, but that's what you wanted, wasn't it? Isn't that what you asked me to do? That's what you asked me. I was agreeing. Tell me that's to understand. That's to understand who his Rebbe is. And that's one of the hardest things. There are sources that say, Ein Adam, Omed al Divrei Raboi, a person does never understand the words of his Rebbe until 40 years after you heard them. We learn it from the 40 years in the desert with Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Jewish people. It's only at the end of the 40 years that they understood what he meant, which means that a person has to mull over what his Rebbe told him and has to work on it for 40 years before he can begin to understand. Again, you can't explain that, you have to know. And you'll find that the way the Rebbe gives it over is done in a way where it depends on the personality and what the Talmud can take and what the Rebbe can express. And we'll finish with this idea. Let's try and understand. There's much more to say. Maybe we'll have to talk about it a second time. Maybe Mitzvah next week. We'll try and talk about it further. But the way the personality goes is that it depends on a number of factors. The first thing is that the Talmud has to understand that the way he learns from his Rebbe, he learns from the man. He doesn't learn from the words that he hears. The first thing we have to know is that in Torah, it's not the words that a person says that show you who he is. It's who the person is that shows you what the words mean. The world thinks, the world that's used to judging superficially, they think that he listens to what a person says. If he says beautiful things and he puts it across well and he's got a grasp of understanding and so on, he must be a great man. But the Torah understanding is much more bitterly perceptive than that. It's not like that at all. Anybody can say nice things. The point is, you first have to see who the person is by a lifetime of bitter trial. And when you see that he stood up to the test of fire for a lifetime, and he really has the content, then you know who he is. And if he is who he is, then whatever he says, you listen carefully. Even if what he says doesn't sound right, so you misunderstood. Not the other way around. The world is used to judging, and Nebuchadnezzar, the world is led by people. The leaders of this generation are such inferior incompetence, to put it kindly, that people don't understand what a Rebbe is. When the nations of the world are led by people who are the last people who should be leading. But it's not only opposite to Torah tradition, it's opposite to the most basic common sense. The people who are ruling other people on earth today are a people who, for whom Gehenna is too small. People who should be tortured to death daily for what they're inflicting on other people. It's not an exaggeration. These are people who are wreaking havoc upon the world and are causing the brute and brutal suffering of millions of people. Death and suffering of millions of people for their own vested interests, and very obviously so. But any common sense should tell a person that the way a country should be run is that the people of the country should go to a man of greatness who wants as the last thing on his agenda to be a leader, and they should force him to be a leader. That's the way Hashem does it. He finds a Moshe Rabbeinu who wants nothing but to be an honor, to be forgotten and alone, and he demands that he should become the leader of the Jewish people, such a person you could maybe trust. By individual who's seeking power, who wants only to be in power, so that you, a person who acquires a leader like that acquires a murderer. There's no question about it. And therefore we don't understand what it means to relate to somebody who's a teacher in the true sense, a leader in the true sense. And the way the Torah teaches a person to learn from the Rebbe is to learn from the man, from the person, from the woman, who are great women teachers also, but to learn from the person, not from what he says. And therefore the key to Torah learning from a person is what's called Shimush. Shimush means to serve the man, to serve the man. I don't need to listen to what he says. You dare not trust what he says until you've served him and seen who he is. And the Gemara says that Shimush was an amazing thing, what they used to do. It's very, very rare to find it today. Very rare. Today Shimush amounts to, if you're lucky, sitting with a great man while he answers questions and seeing how he behaves. But real Shimush, until the last generation, until 1800 certainly, Shimush was where you went to live in his house and you became a slave. You became an unbidden slave. You covered him at night. You lay at his feet. You did everything that you could for him. You behaved like a slave in order to be privy to his secret moments, to be able to see him. And the Rebbe, of course, would try and discourage it. If you were lucky, you were allowed to do that. We're talking about a person himself who was so humble that the last thing he wanted was anybody to serve him. And that's what they used to do. And the Gemara tells stories of shamashim, people who served their Rebbe, in the most incredible ways. What they tried to do, the Gemara has a story. The Gemara tells of a Tana and a Moira who followed his Rebbe into the bathroom. Followed into the bathroom. So the Rebbe turned and said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Rebbe, it's Torah, I have to learn." The Gemara has a story about a Talmid lay under the bed of his Rebbe. His bed. It's not. It's what his wife. He said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Rebbe, it's Torah, I have to learn." People who didn't have any chutzpah. But it means Shimush. It means not just sitting in a class and listening between one nap and the next. It means learning from the man. The Gemara says that once Rabbi Akiva arrived late. He arrived late. So his teacher said to him, great Tanoim, they said to him, "Why are you late?" So Rabbi Akiva said, "I'm late because I came across a Mais Mitzvah." A Mais Mitzvah means a person who died and there's no one to bury him. And the Torah says that's one of the greatest mitzvahs you could do. Take precedence over almost all else. If there's a dead person who needs to be buried and there's no one to do it, so then it takes precedence over almost everything else. So Rabbi Akiva says, "I had to carry him to a place where I could bury him, and I buried him, and that's why I'm late." So they said to him, "Rabbi Akiva, with every step that you took, it's as if you spilled blood." They said to him. He was tremendously shocked. Why? Because you came late to Torah learning. So the kid didn't understand, and the commentaries all asked, but a Mais Mitzvah, definitely, you come across a Mais Mitzvah, you've got a Mitzvah to do now. And the only answer they come up with, one of the answers, one that I've seen, is that because Rebbe Kippur wasn't learning from them. Had Rebbe Kippur learned from them, were they his Torah teachers only, so then definitely Mais Mitzvah would have taken precedence, but he was doing Shemesh with them. That's such a great level. That means to serve a man of Torah in that way, that you absorb what he is as a human being, so nothing comes before that. Understand this. And therefore you have a way that the Rebbe, that the closeness that the Talmid tries to generate to his Rebbe, and he tries to drink in what he is and what he says, and he tries to absorb the way his mind works. I'll give you an example. I heard this from our Rosh Kodam. He said this thing to me in another way, but I understood it because the Gemara says the following idea. He learned by the great Rav Nochum of Mir. My own Rosh Kodam, his Rebbe was Rav Nochum of Mir and Rav Chaim of Mir. He learned from the two of them. How did he become a Talmud? Just understand this. How did he become a Talmud of Rav Nochum? Today, this man that I'm talking about is one of the greatest Rosh Hashivas in the world. I've heard from someone who is acknowledged to be a leading Rosh Hashiva today of this generation and of the previous generation. He said that this young man, who himself is only a little older than I am, heads the best kollel in the world. Today, that's an incredible statement. I heard from a man in his 90s that if he was able, he would sit at his feet and learn from this man. If he didn't have so many other responsibilities, and he's done it too. He's come to at least two shirim while I was in that college. A man of 90, in his 90s from the previous generation, a man of towering greatness. He comes and sits at the feet of this young man in his 30s to learn Torah from him because he sees a real teacher. You can't convey this to you. You have to see people like this. You have to see what it means. But my Rosh Kodesh told me the following thing. Told me a story, but it boils down to this. That first of all, how did he become a Talmud of his teacher, Rav Nochum? This is what happened. He was 17 years old in Lakewood in New York. East Coast. And he was learning in Lakewood. And one day Rav Nochum came there from Mir in Yerushalayim. Came from Eretz Israel and he gave a shir in Mir Yeshiva. That's all. He gave a shir. This young man of 17 saw him and said, "That's my Rebbe." And he left with him, went back to Eretz Israel and he sat at his feet for the next 17 years. Until Rav Nochum became very, very sick and he died 3 years ago. Four years ago. But until then he stayed with him. And he absorbed everything from him. He said that he told me that he would never do anything without asking him. No matter what it was, he asked him first. And if he couldn't ask him first, he asked him after, did I do the right thing or not? Until he absorbed so intensely what his Rebbe's mind was, that he knew what his Rebbe would say, what he knows today, what his Rebbe would say, clearly can even hear the words, even if he never asked him. The Gemara says, that Rebbe Elazar Agadol, Rebbe Eliezer, the great, his middah was bor sucha anima abetipa. The Gemara says, the Mishnah says about him, that he was like a plastered cistern that never lost a drop. He was able to hold without losing a drop. He never forgot anything that he heard. His middah, there were other rabbis who were so great they were able to be mechadish. That means they poured out Torah that was new. But his middah was, he was what's called nefesh, it's a mystical discussion, but he was a certain kind of personality that can hold and never lose a drop. So the Gemara says about him the following incredible statement, and this is a famous, wonderful thing. The Gemara says that he never said anything that he hadn't heard from his rabbi. Again, he never said anything. That means when he taught Torah, one of the greatest Torah teachers who ever lived, he was a teacher of Rabbi Akiva, He never said anything he didn't hear from his Rebbe. Ever. Then the Gemara says, brings an example, where Rabbi Eliezer said things, his teacher said to him, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a teacher. The Gemara talks about the difference between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the greatest of his group of people. The only difference is, it says, they both knew the language of the birds, the language of the trees, they knew every aspect of Torah, everything he needs to know about the world. The only thing is, when a bird flew over his head, one of them was so great that the bird would fly over, the other one was so great that the bird flew over his head would be singed, charred black, and fall to earth, and it flew anywhere in his vicinity. Don't ask me about Tzar Bale Chaim, I don't know, but that's what happened. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a teacher of Rebbe Eliezer, and it happened once that he said to him, say something. He said to him, teach Torah. And Rebbe Eliezer opened up Pasach Bo'amar, he opened up and said words that no ear had ever heard. Dvarim Shelo Shaman Oizim Me'olam. Words that no ear had ever heard, he was able to say. That means he was able to open up a Kabbalistic depth and teach Torah that no one on earth had ever heard. Ever heard! Moshe Rabbeinu, Rebbe, no one had ever heard. So the commentaries say, what's going on? You said about this man that he never said anything he'd never heard from his Rebbe. That means it was certainly said before. Certainly it was said before. His Rebbe must have said it. That's how he heard it. And if he heard it, he said it. He never said anything he did. So what do you mean he said things that nobody had ever heard? You hear the contradiction. It couldn't be more blatant. So the Mefarshim answer as follows. Rav Nochum of Mir and Rav Chaim Shmulevitz of Mir, they both had two different opinions. And I heard this from a man who epitomizes this. If anybody on earth that I've ever met is this is the person. And he told me the following thing, that his two rabbis used to have a standing argument for many years, what's chat? What exactly does it mean that he said things that no one had ever heard, and he said only that which he'd heard from his Rebbe? How do you resolve that? They're two opinions. And they're both very, very similar. And it's this. He never said anything he hadn't heard from his Rebbe. Absolutely not. Everything he heard was from his Rebbe. And true, he said things that no one else had ever heard. You know what it means? He was able to say things that no one had ever heard. But where did he get it from? He heard it in the words of his Rebbe. The one opinion was this. When his Rebbe taught, he was able to listen, and he was able to hear so deep that he could bring out from between the lines, he could say, and when he brought it out, you see that that's what his Rebbe had said. No one had ever heard the statement before. It was so great and so beautiful. But when you understood the statement, and you understood the Torah that he was saying, you understood where he got it from, and it was perfect and exactly, all he did, in other words, was he showed what his Rebbe had said. You wouldn't have understood it. That was his greatness, and that's what he was here for. The other opinion is, no, he didn't read it between the lines of what his Rebbe said. You wouldn't find it. It wasn't evil. If you looked in the words of his Rebbe, you wouldn't see that. But what it means is, he knew his Rebbe so intimately and so well, that he was able to say what his Rebbe would have said about that thing. That means he never said it, but just by accident, he never happened to say it. But he said it so clear and so good, so pure and so close to the source of what his Rebbe was, that there's no question his Rebbe would have said that. And that we've seen many times. I'll tell you two examples. There was a case in a certain yeshiva. A group of Bochrim came to the Rebbe, and they said to the Rebbe, we found a Rashi that we can't understand. This is an amazing story. This happened in this generation. We found a Rashi that we can't understand. In an outlying Masechta that people don't often learn, Rashi says the following thing, and it doesn't make any sense. So the Rebbe said the following thing, you're making a mistake. I've never seen that Rashi. Listen to this. This is a well-known, a man who specialized in Rashi. Rashi's commentary, it absorbs it in all its depth, such as is possible in our generation. He said, you're making a mistake. I've never seen that Rashi, but he can't say that. It's just not Rashi. They went back and checked that, made a mistake. He had so absorbed the mind, the way of thinking of that great giant Rashi. You know, it happened. You understand what this means to be able to absorb the mind of someone. It happened, an incredible thing happened in the first part of the century, around the turn of the century. There was a young yeshiva man who forged a copy of the Yerushalmi. To understand what this means. In the Gemara Yerushalmi, you know, we don't have all the Masechtas. We don't have all the tractates of the Gemara. We have, in the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, we have a certain number of tractates. In Yerushalmi, we have fewer. It's not clear if they were never written, or perhaps they're missing. So a young yeshiva man faked a Masechta of the Yerushalmi. Anybody who knows what Gemara is, but they're amazed by such a thing. I mean, just to be able to understand one line of the Gemara is a work that takes a lifetime. But to be able to dream up and write a whole tractate of the Gemara, right, possibly, that means that it would read like a Gemara, with a depth and logic and cohesiveness that a Gemara has. A stupendous human feat. An unbelievable feat. So he, that was his idea of a joke. You know, that's the kind of problem Jews we had in that generation. You know, somebody would fake a Yerushalmi. You understand, you know. That's the criminal element that the Jewish people had until 100 years ago. You know, that was the Jewish, you know, that was the worst you could find, you know. Somebody's idea of a joke was to, just for fun, write a copy of the Gemara. And instead, what we've sunk to in this generation, this hopeless, almost hopeless generation. But anyway, that's what he did. And he showed it to the Gedolim of his day. He showed it to great men. And many great people gave us comments. Many great people testified that this is a great find. Until he came to the Rogachava. The Rogachava Gaon was a man who was so sharp. He was of such acerbic wit and of such sharpness. I mean, he once referred to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman as a leading light of his generation as a malamed, you know, like a cheder teacher. He was a great light of Torah in his day. The Rogachava was incredibly sharp. I mean, you'll permit me 2 minutes, I'll just take an aside just to show you who he was. Rogachava was a man. Instead of what a teacher was, what a Rebbe was. He was a man of such genius that when he was dying, he was in such pain that he couldn't stand the pain. He was in tremendous pain. And in those days, he didn't have anything effective to relieve his pain. So what did they do? The Yeshiva Bochrim went into him one after another to talk to him in learning. Because when he started talking in Torah, he didn't feel any pain at all. That was his level. He was in incredible agony. And all they had to do was engage him in a Torah conversation. And there was a man of his generation, by the way, went through a full operation without an anesthetic, because an anesthetic, the doctor said, was dangerous for him. He says, not a problem. He says, just pass me a masechta of such and such. He lay on the operating table, he went through the Gemara, and they finished the operation and feel a thing. Yeah? One of the Hasidic rabbis of that generation. No problem at all. Not a concentration. So the Rogachava was in agony. So the Bochrim went to speak to the Rogachava in learning. So when they engaged him in a discussion in Torah in learning, he didn't feel any pain. The trouble is, the Rogachava was so sharp and so acerbic and so... He was so fiery that no one could stand his comments. So no Bocher would dare to go speak to him in learning. Because the things that he would slice you up. But nobody could stand up to him. Not even the best of them could stand up to him. So what did they do? What are they going to do? They're going to speak in learning and be fried.
So they this is what they did. The Bochrim in the yeshiva, they studied up Rabbi Kiva Eger's comments on the Gemara had just come out. Rabbi Kiva Eger was an incredible luminary of his day also. And a whole discussion to describe him also. Rabbi Kiva Eger was an incredible genius in Torah, whose commentaries are on many pages of the Gemara. While he learned the Gemara, what's called Bekiyas, that means as he flew through the Gemara, he used to note down a few little points here and there through the Gemara, which are some of the deepest questions that we have today. Almost unstoppable questions. When he leaves the Tzorich Iyun, this needs further thought, when Rabbi Kiva Eger leaves the Tzorich Iyun, it's almost impossible. You have to be a very foolhardy individual, has a very, very enormous self-confidence to tackle such a question. They're one of the heaviest and deepest questions ever been asked in our day. So that all the Bochrim swatted up a question of Rabbi Kiva Eger that the Rogachev hadn't seen, it had just come out. You follow? So they didn't tell him where they got it. Each Bocher went in and he asked the question of this giant. Follow? Each young yeshiva Bocher, are you with me? He went into this man in agony and he said, Rabbi, I'd like to ask you a question. And he asked him a question that Rabbi Kiva Eger asked on the Gemara without telling him where it came from. So the story goes that one after another the Bochrim went in and he answered them all on the spot. And at the end he said, good Bochrim. There's Rabbi Kiva Eger. That was Rabbi Chava. So the Rabbi Chava, just to show you how his mind, and one day he was learning with the Osamach. Just trying to give ourselves a little filia for who these great people were. One day he sat in the Beis Medrash, his Chavrusa was the Or Samach, after whom this yeshiva is named. The great Or Samach, named after him because he had no children. They lived in Minsk. In Dvinsk, he was the leading Torah authority in Dvinsk, first part of the century. One day they were sitting and learning together, and they both had incredible sense of humor. Tremendous, biting wit. They were sitting and learning together. So they came to a thesis they couldn't agree on. They had a massive argument about the thesis. The one said chat one way, the other one said the other. Couldn't settle it. So as they were busy arguing, a man walked into the Beis Medrash. He was never a man who was known that he always said wrong. Whatever you asked him, he always said wrong. It was a Rav from another town. This man was always, it was well known. Unfortunately, they had a krum kop. And he'd always say whatever. So they both made a plan. They said, listen, we'll go and ask him. And whatever he says, the other one will be right. So the Rogachev agreed. So they went over and they asked the man, and he said, Lakta Osamach. So they sat down at the table, so Rogachev looked across and he said, no. So Osamach said, look, so the Osamach said, look, it's just before Pesach, and he's confused. He just said right because he's confused, but had he been thinking straight, he would have said wrong. That's a Gemara joke. Anyway, these were the. So when this young man took his copy of the Gemara Yerushalmi that he had forged, faked, right, fraudulently produced, he showed it to the Rogachev. Rogachev took one look at the Gemara and he said, Rabbi Meir says this and this. This is a forgery. So the young man admitted it. He said, how did you know? So Rogachev said, because you say over here that Rabbi Meir says such and such. He could never say that. It's just not consistent with who he was. That means he was able to look into the mind. Right? He knew the mind of the Tanna at his level so deeply that he could look at one comment of the Tanna and say, this is a fact. That man could never have said that. That means he absorbed his mind so intimately, so intensely, was able to say that. And he finds that, finally, we'll just try and make this point, that the way the mind of the Rebbe works and the way the mind of the Talmud works is that it's a perfect marriage so that the Talmud can reflect the mind of the Rebbe. And in general, I just want to make one, talk about one detail of this relationship that often misunderstood. And that's as follows. There are two kinds of Rebbeim in Klal Yisrael. The person has to remember this and understand it. Some of the things we said this evening are confusing. So we're trying to just begin to open up the subject. There are two kinds of Rebbeim. Let's just leave ourselves with this idea. You have the kind of Rebbe who is completely humble and can be walked on and trampled on, and he's completely soft and doesn't hit back or bite. And you have the kind of Rebbe who's fire. The Gemara says, beware of the Talmidei Chachamim because their sting is a scorpion sting and they bite, they fire, they bite. Serpents bite and a scorpion sting. They're very, very sharp. The Talmid has to know, he has to be able to take it from his Rebbe. His Rebbe has to tell him what's wrong with him, or he has to correct him. He has to be able to take it. But there are two different kinds of Rebbe. There is, the Gemara says that if a person has to choose which way to be, should be like Hillel and not like Shammai. Hillel was a man who was easily the Gemara tells the famous story, the source of this, the two lines in Torah, always has been the gentle line, the chesed line, the right hand side, and then there's always been the tough, the line of fire and of discipline. That's always been called the left hand side, the line of Shammai. The Gemara says that a certain non-Jew, a certain Jew, a certain person came, a non-Jew also came, a certain Jew came to see Shammai, and he bothered him, he asked him silly questions. He had a bet with his friend, a bet. The Gemara brings the whole story. It's all Amud of Gemara, interesting, going into the details now. But this man came to Shammai. Shammai was from the line of Rebbeim that are fire. And he said to him, he asked him stupid questions. And Shammai drove him out with what's called a builder's yard. He used to carry around a builder's yardstick. And unfortunately, Maharal says it doesn't mean he carried his stick around. It means he did everything by measure. He was perfect in. And he held that for the honor of Torah, he had to be fiery like that. And he chased him out. So the man went to Hillel. The bet was whether he could upset and disturb that Hillel. So he took his friend to bet 400 zuz, I think it was a fortune. He went to Hillel, and he chose to get him on Friday afternoon, as he was in the bath just before Shabbos. The tensest time of the week. In any frum home, if fights do break out between husband and wife, that's the time, because the house is tense, and there's only minutes to go before Shabbos, and things aren't finished. So he stood outside and he said, Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel. Called him by his first name. No Revi, no title of respect. Who's Hillel, who's Hillel? So Hillel came out in his bath, got out the bath, and he said, yes, my son. That was his way. So he said to him, why do the Patagonians have wide feet? So Hillel said, because they walk on soft sand, my son. So they don't sink in. Went back to his bath. So he came back a few minutes later and said, Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel. And a full voice, everybody could hear. So Hillel came out and said, yes, my son. He said, why do the Chinese have narrow eyes? He said, they have a lot of sandstorms, my son. Narrow eyes, sand doesn't get it. And again and again, and he asked him, and he gave him a... Those are the deep questions and answers also. I'm not going to go into that. Done enough about it. Finally, he said, he couldn't upset him. So he said, may there be few like you in Israel. May there not be more like you. Even that Hillel had to hear. So he said, my son, why do you say that? So he said, because of you, I've lost a fortune. So Hillel said to him, better that you should lose a fortune than Hillel should get upset. That's what he said. And that's a famous piece of Gemara. You see, there were Rebbeim who could be treated that way without losing any of the honor of the Torah. Depends when to be sharp, when not to be sharp. Rabbi Akiva Haggai himself was a man who was very soft. He himself, the one we mentioned before, he could be walked all over. But when he felt it was the honor of the Torah, he used to say things that people sometimes lost their lives because of. When the need was to be sharp, it's well known that a certain man wouldn't give his wife a divorce. There was a certain man who would not give his wife a get that he was obliged to give her. And they brought the man to see Rabbi Akiva Haggai, and he couldn't be forced. So Rabbi Akiva, he said quietly to the man, "Is that Isha Yetzes Beget or Bemesas Habal?" That's all he said to him. He said to him, "A woman goes out from with a divorce or the death of the husband." That's what he said. A divorce or the death. So the man said, "No, he's not giving a divorce." So Rabbi Akiva quietly said to him again, "Isha Yetzes, a woman goes out by a divorce or by the death of the husband." And he stormed out the house and dropped dead on the front steps. There are many cases of things like that Rabbi Akiva Haggai was able to do that happened in the world. But unless that was the case with the honor of Torah, or some specific need, he could walk all over it. And there have always been those two lines. And a person has to be very careful when he chooses a Rebbe if he can take it. Rebbe Yisrael Zalman Meltzer in Yerushalayim in the last generation was a man of incredible stature, a man, a very unusual man. And if somebody said something wrong in his presence, he was a towering giant, physically and spiritually. If someone said something wrong in his presence, he would smile gently and say, yes, yes, you probably mean, and then he would say the correct way, not to offend the person. And at the same time, there was the brisker Rabbi in Yerushalayim. If somebody said something in front of him that wasn't perfect Torah, he started to shake uncontrollably. Right? He couldn't take it. He had to take the person out. Right? There have been always those two lines. If a person has to choose, he should choose to be like Hillel. But if his personality is that, that's what he has to be. I happen to have been zoifet to learn from someone, and I say too much, who is somebody who happens to be particularly fiery. Particularly fiery. I once heard him express this idea. He once said that the Chedush HaRim says, beautiful thing, you know, there's a halacha that a man must walk on the left of his Rebbe. When a man's walking together with his Rebbe, or somebody that he respects, he must walk on his left. Because the place of honor is at the right hand side. So when you walk with someone you respect, you must walk with him at your right. That's the place of honor. So the Gemara says that a man who walks on the right of his Rebbe is a bull, a fool. He's an idiot, he's a fool. He doesn't know anything, he doesn't learn anything. So the Chiddush HaRiv asks, why is he a fool? He walks on the wrong side. So he walks on the right, so he doesn't know the halacha. Why does it call him a fool? Doesn't know anything, never amount to anything, because he walks on the wrong side of his Rebbe. It's a beautiful insight of the Chiddush HaRiv, one of the great Rebbe's of Gur. Grandfather's first MS, he said the following thing. The right and left don't mean the right and left. By the way, it does also mean the right and left. Halacha is you must walk on the left-hand side of the Rebbe. But it means much more than that. The right-hand side is always the side of the Rebbe that's kind and full of chesed. And the left-hand side of the Rebbe is always the side that's rock hard and full of discipline. A man who walks on the right-hand side of the Rebbe, that's a man who only wants to hear praise. He wants the gentle hand. He wants the hand of kindness and praise from his Rebbe. So he stands on the right. So he can't stand his walk on the left. The left is the side of discipline where he gets smashed by the Rebbe. And he can't take that. So such a man's a fool, because unless he puts himself in to being able to be put down where it's necessary and be corrected correctly by his Rebbe, he won't amount to anything. That's what he has to be able to do. And I heard him say, I personally heard him say, and he's one of the greatest men of this generation, indescribable giant. I heard him say that before he heard a word of praise, this is, of all the things I've heard him say, this is the one that I have difficulty believing. Right? When I have to make an effort to believe him, this is the statement. This is the only statement. And I heard him say with my own ears that before he heard a word of praise from his teachers, and I know who his teachers were, I know who his rabbis were, his rabbis. Before I heard a word of praise, and he would never exaggerate, he would never say a word that isn't perfectly true, and I heard him say this, that before I heard a word of praise from my rabbis, I heard them call me a fool 100 times. I can't imagine anybody calling him a fool. Not in his youngest years. And that's what I heard him say. And how does he teach? If he had said to me some of the things that I've heard him say to some other people, I don't think I could have survived him. Once in a shir, just to give you a faint taste. Once in a shir, someone asked a question, a foolish question. He looked across the hall and he said to him, that question is not even stupid. So 5 minutes later, the same person had the gall to ask another question. He said, that's already stupid. If it was an Israeli audience, I could take it. And he once said that he's descended from the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi was a man who taught Torah in this fashion. He was a regal, royal personality who did exactly what he did and what was right in an absolutely royal way. Conducted himself in the conduct of Malchus, and you have to be perfect to do that. If you're easily walked upon and you're humble and you bend easily, so then you can afford to make mistakes. But if you're going to hold yourself to be in the fiery mode, you can't afford mistakes. You look like a fool. Now Chacham Tzvi was able to do that. And he said, I can say this because I'm descended from him. And he told the story. And the story is a well-known story, that the Chacham Tzvi was so fiery that in his day, in Europe, the town where he was Rav, they were unable to get on with him. He was so royal, so regal, and so demanding that the people... And he had to leave. He had to leave. So what did he do? He went to the house of a certain poor, poverty-stricken Jew, poor Jew. He walked in and he said, I've come to stay. Walked into the house and asked permission, said, I've come to stay. So the Jew was overawed by this great Torah presence, and he started serving him. He started serving him and looking after him. And the Chacham Tzvi conducted himself in a way that made it very difficult. Very difficult. And after a lengthy period of staying with this man, one day this humble, poor individual came to him and he said, Rebbe, I just have to tell you, I can't take it anymore. I just can't live like this. So the Chacham Tzvi said to him the following thing. I want you to know that in exactly a week from now, I will receive a delegation from Vienna. They will come and ask me to be their rabbi, their Rebbe, and I'll accept the invitation. And therefore I'm staying another week. Staying another week in your house. And because you've hosted me, because I've been in your house, I'm going to give you a brocha, I'm going to give you a blessing. And had you not spoken up now, had you been silent for one more week, I would have given you a blessing, at soif kol adoris. That means a blessing that would have gone in your family until the end of all generations for incredible wealth. But because you spoke up, I'm going to give you a brocha anyway, but not necessarily soif kol adoris. And he gave him a brocha for wealth, and that was the father of the first Rothschild. That's the family connection. That's a true story. You see that there are two pathways. Even a Rebbe who can be gentle, but a person must be able to take it when the Rebbe's not. If it doesn't involve discipline, if a person isn't able to hear things that are scorching and know how to take it and know how to correct himself and mavatal himself so he can absorb what the Rebbe is teaching, so then he won't amount to anything. We'll leave it there for this.